This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today's somber weather matches the mood of this week's news. From the chilling cross-examination of James Whitey Bulger's longtime partner, Stephen Flemmy.
He did it. He did it. If he wasn't saying he did it, he said Jim Bulger did it.
To a postponed probable cause hearing for former Patriots tight end Aaron Hernandez and a long-awaited reflection from his teammates and coach.
You know, it's a sad day. It's really a sad day. On so many levels.
And to the horrific kidnapping and murder of a young South Boston woman.
We need to find justice for Amy Lord, for her family and her friends.
We'll discuss all of these stories with our Week in Review panel. But first, let's go directly to South Boston, where the community is responding to the murder of Amy Lord. The 24-year-old was kidnapped early Tuesday morning, driven to five different ATMs and forced to withdraw money, then stabbed to death before her body was found in Hyde Park's Stony Brook Reservation.
Boston Police have increased foot patrols in the neighborhood, and this afternoon the city is holding a community meeting to talk about safety. WBUR's Kurt Nickisch is there. And Kurt, what is the latest on the investigation itself?
Well, Boston Mayor Tom Menino was here moments ago with news that call for justice may be a little bit closer to being answered. And that's that he said that Boston Police have in custody the man that they think is responsible for Amy Lord's kidnapping and slaying. Now, he declined to give a name, but he said that this person is in custody and that police are just waiting for tests to come back on DNA and fingerprints before they file charges. But they did have somebody in custody for two similar attacks nearby on the same day, Edwin Alamany, and all indications are that that is the person who police believe is responsible for Amy Lord's death now.
So a dramatic turn in this case, perhaps. I understand that Boston police are planning a press conference on this a little later this afternoon, sometime after 5 o'clock. How did people at the community meeting where you're at right now react to the news?
Well, some here were very, very relieved to hear that. There are dozens and dozens of people here just already in the first hour and a little bit of this community outreach and interface that police and city officials are holding. They were happy to hear that there. You saw a lot of people hugging each other, but there are also a lot of people still picking up flyers and picking up safety whistles that police are handing out, because it's not just those three perhaps linked attacks on Tuesday. There have been other attacks here recently, and I think the fact that Boston Police's Superintendent Billy Evans, who's a South Boston resident, is here, just shows how seriously the city is sort of responding to this concern that so many people have here, even with today's news.
Well, finally, Kurt, tell me a little bit more about that. What are city officials saying about safety overall in South Boston?
Well, Mayor Menino just said that this city streets are safe. He said that, you know, he has women family members who live in the city, and he said people shouldn't stop, you know, walking home and walking to work and doing the things that they normally do, but maybe be more vigilant. And so that's the sort of stuff that police are handing out. It's sort of general safety precautions, things that you should do, but nobody here is suggesting that, you know, the landscape of danger is really significantly different and that people should do anything significantly different.
Well, that's WBUR's Kurt Nickisch speaking to us from a community meeting out at South Boston, where just a little while ago, Boston Mayor Tom Menino said that law enforcement officials do have a suspect in custody in connection with the Amy Lord murder case. Kurt, thank you so much.
But of course.
And let's turn now to our Week in Review team. Callum Borchers is business reporter for the Boston Globe. Callum, thanks for joining us. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me.
And Peter Ubertasio, chair of the Political Science Department and director of the Joseph Martin Institute for Law and Society at Stonehill College. Welcome back to you, Peter. Good to have you.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with this really awful story, the abduction and murder of Amy Lord. We heard Kurt Nickisch there in South Boston. Terrible crime. It's also a story about a community very much on edge about the horror of the sort of sheer randomness of this murder. Callum, let me come to you first of all. What strikes you about this story and the way folks have responded to it?
Well, I think that what strikes me is how unnerving it is. And, you know, we have, you know, crimes in the city all the time, but few, I think, like this make us feel less safe, simply because you take an example like the Odin Lloyd murder case that we're going to talk about later with Aaron Hernandez. You know, you look at that and you say that's a terrible tragedy, but I don't feel unsafe because at least I say, you know, he was mixed up with the wrong people and you could see how it could happen. This seemed so random and so cold. I think that is really what has freaked people out.
Yeah. Peter, your view?
I think Kyle's exactly right. It's the random and vicious nature of this attack that makes it the stuff of nightmares. We know that folks who are victims of crime tend to know their attacker.
That's
or
right.
They tend to be involved in crime themselves. And in an instance like this, where it's completely random and someone is literally taken out of their home, abducted, beaten, and then killed, and she apparently doesn't know her attacker. That's what makes it so unnerving.
Mm. Well, we heard Kurt Nickisch referring to Mayor Menino, making the point that Boston is still a safe city. The city streets are safe. We spoke yesterday to Gershon Ben-Koren. He's a self-defense instructor at a studio in Charlestown. And he spoke to us extremely intelligently about this issue. And one of the points he made is that as awful as this particular crime is, it is extremely rare. Here's what he said.
As horrific as the assault on Amy was, it's still not the most common type of assault that women face. The number of sexual assaults of women in their own home, the number of street muggings far outweigh these events. And while people are thinking about personal safety at this time, they should really review personal safety in their entire life rather than just concentrate on this one type of assault.
Sounds like wise advice to me, Callum, especially this idea that, and Peter, you mentioned this too, that crimes of this nature typically happen between people who know each other, that this sort of random nature of this crime is extremely rare.
Yeah, I would say that's right, although I think that the other step, of course, is what we can say, okay, this is rare, but also, you know, what can we learn and what's the opportunity here? And, of course, we've heard some calls in the wake of this crime for increased security at ATMs. And, of course, we have this sort of, you know, languishing ATM security bill in the legislature. But even that has a loophole, right, because it doesn't cover cash machines at a gas station, let's say. So even that. And I'm reminded, Anthony, of a story I wrote, you know, a few months ago about these new ATMs that Bank of America was installing in Boston, which sort of act like a Skype machine, basically, with a real person as a teller who you're communicating with. And there's, of course, a camera implanted in every single one of those ATMs. If that is the future of our ATMs, then perhaps we'd all feel a little bit safer.
Yeah, what do you think, Peter? Are those the kind of approaches that would make sense? Or what lessons should come out of this?
Well, I think it's still too early to know. I mean, we don't really know the exact circumstances of this crime. And we know that it's a great tragedy. And I think it's chilling when we look and see where she was brought by this stranger. I think it's really difficult to tell. But I think Callum's point about, you know, ATM and greater security there is probably the most likely lesson learned. And also, you know, how to handle yourself in those kinds of situations. I think beyond those two things, I'm not sure that there's much to learn when we've got such a random criminal action.
Well, let's turn now to more criminal action or alleged criminal action, and that is in regards to the case against James Whitey Bulger going on at the Moakley Federal Courthouse. The government rested its case today, showing the jury some $800,000 in cash and 30 firearms that the FBI allegedly found hidden in the walls of Bulger's Santa Monica apartment when they arrested him back in 2011. But of course, as we all know, this week was really dominated by the testimony of Stephen the Rifleman Flemmy, Bulger's longtime associate. Flemmy testified and tried to tie Bulger to a number of murders. Here's WBUR's David Boeri describing that testimony on Morning Edition earlier this week.
By saying, he did it, he did it. Everything he's doing here is pointing at Bulger. And it's interesting to see, because if you thought that Flemmy was a partner of Bulger, it's a surprise to see that he's putting most of the blame on Bulger, and he's painting himself more as a foot soldier than as a partner.
So, Callum, let's start with you. Flemmy, as more of a foot soldier than a partner, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I sort of take it with a grain of salt. I mean, you know, what else is he going to say?
He's already serving a life sentence for murder, right?
Right, and like I say, that sort of seems like a logical thing to do. I mean, the part of his testimony this week that really stood out to me more was this business about him and Whitey sort of sharing this weakness, as he put it, for teenage girls. I think that really sort of changed the complexion a little bit. You know, Bulger, for I think a generation of Bostonians, is sort of this mythical figure, right? I mean, it's easy sometimes to forget, you know, that he's this sort of, you know, allegedly this fearsome, ferocious person, and you remember, you know, so like, oh, he's sort of this fun, he's on the run, you know, there was sort of the drama of it, right? And this is really serious stuff, though. I mean, there's no romanticizing, there's no myth-making when you're talking about pedophilia.
No, not at all. And the detail, Peter, with which the testimony has been going on really reminds you that for, as Callum says, for all the myth-making that's going on, there are actual victims and their families who continue to suffer due to all the crimes that Bulger is alleged to have committed.
I think if there was any mystique that surrounded Whitey Bulger, any mystique left going into this week, it evaporated. This was, I found, the most difficult week of testimony,
yeah.
The most difficult to listen to. And for anyone who it remains of the mind that he was a great defender of South Boston and were willing to overlook his sort of roguish qualities because he so loved his hometown, it's pretty clear that he didn't love his hometown at all, that he was willing to put his neighbors, his friends in danger, that he is chilling in his brutality.
Mm. Well, as we mentioned, the government rested its case today, which means Bulger's defense team begins its own case and bringing their own witnesses next week. That list of witnesses, though, has been significantly whittled down due to a ruling by Judge Denise Casper that testimony from several people on the list was basically irrelevant. Here's Bulger's defense attorney, J.W. Carney, speaking to reporters outside of court yesterday afternoon on
this intend
point.
To call all of the defense witnesses that we are permitted to. Right now, that is potentially 16 people.
So, Peter, do you think it matters to the defense team that they've had a lot of their witnesses knocked off the list?
I don't think so. I mean, I you know, if they're repetitive and irrelevant, the judge is probably right. And I think that is a tactic. You tend to load up your list with people who are all going to say essentially the same thing. So I'm not sure it's going to matter much. And after this week's testimony, I mean, I'm really looking forward to the defense here. But after this week's testimony, I'm sort of curious about what is going to matter in this case beyond, say, the greater implication of folks like the FBI and the government, which can really, you know, muddy and has muddy the waters in this issue for a while.
Callum, your thoughts?
Yeah, I think that Peter's right. And I think that it makes probably little difference because what I suspect we'll hear in the coming week is more of what we heard during opening arguments from the defense, which is that this case isn't really so much about Whitey Bulger's misdeeds as it is about law enforcement corruption. You know, that was really where they tried to cast the focus early on in the case, and my guess is that's probably where we'll return to this week.
You know, before we leave this issue of Bulger and the murder of Amy Lord, it strikes me that, you know, here we have South Boston in two different points in time, you know, two different sort of types of stories and issues affecting the community. And within, you know, it's a sort of bookending how that part of the city has changed so much. We go from sort of gangster crime to what may be a random act of crime still affecting the neighborhood, but in an entirely different generation of people living there. I mean, South Boston sort of encapsulated over the past generation in stories this week, Callum.
Yeah, and I see real disconnect, fortunately, in what I see spending time. You know, lately I've been spending a fair amount of time in South Boston in what the mayor calls that innovation district,
exactly.
Right? And you know, what I see in South Boston today is this sort of growing, you know, increasingly prosperous, innovative area with startup companies and, you know, exciting innovations coming out of there. I hope that is what the country comes to know South Boston for more than for these terrible crimes.
And maybe we in the media ought to take note of that.
Yeah.
And not keep going back when there's just crime-related stories, Peter.
Well, I think, you know, I'm old enough now to remember when the Seaport District was, as Kevin Cullen described it in his Globe column today, a very seedy, unpleasant place to be. And I just happened to be there the other day, and you just take a look around, and it's amazing the changes that have occurred in that part of the city. And so this, you know, the Bulger trial is really a throwback to a time that many Bostonians simply don't remember and don't have any recollection of because it seems like a completely different era.
Yeah, and that in and of itself is, I think, is the story of South Boston as it goes forward.
Well, as we've mentioned, this has been a week of crime stories that we seem to be focusing on. So let's move on to another. The case of former Patriots tight end Aaron Hernandez, who's accused of murdering 27-year-old semi-pro football player Odin Lloyd. He could also face charges for the murder of two other men last July. This week, we heard from Patriots head coach Bill Belichick and quarterback Tom Brady. They talked about the case for the first time. Belichick is not known for being particularly expressive. I think that's a fair statement. But on Wednesday, when he met with reporters, he answered a series of questions fairly openly for Bill Belichick. Here, let's listen to a little bit.
As the coach of the team, You know, I'm primarily responsible for the people that we bring into the football operation. Sometimes they've made bad or immature decisions, but we try to look at every single situation on a case-by-case basis and try to do what's best for the football team and what's best for the franchise. Most of those decisions have worked out, but some don't.
And yesterday, Patriots quarterback Tom Brady also talked about the case, and here's what he had to say.
Certainly, it's a very tragic thing that happened, and all those things were out of, you know, the player's control here. We're not really a part of that situation, so I don't think it does a lot for us to get too much involved in that. I think that we've, as a team, have, you know, tried to move forward with, you know, better awareness and understanding of these types of things, and hopefully, you know, nothing like this ever happens again.
So, Callum, your colleague at the Globe, Christopher Gasper, made the point today that addressing a murder charge against one of the men who used to catch your passes is not really in the franchise quarterback handbook, which I thought was a good line. Still, he suggested that Belichick was pretty open about discussing this case, while Brady, not so much.
Yeah, it was surprising to me to see that reversal, actually. And you saw Belichick come out with this sort of prepared statement. I remain convinced he has some type of voice modulation disorder. It didn't really sound very emotional. Yeah. But if you just look at the content of what he said, you know, he actually did describe being, you know, personally saddened and disappointed. I think that, you know, for a lot of football coaches, right, they sort of take on a father figure type role. They're about that age frequently in relation to their players. And I think that, you know, in his case, you have a lot of players come out of college like Aaron Hernandez. And this is not the first time they've taken a gamble on a guy who fell in the draft because of some types of character questions. In Hernandez's case, it was drug related from his days at the University of Florida. And you believe that you can help this guy turn his life around and turn him into a productive football player. And for several years, that appeared to be the case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. And Peter, let me ask you, because I mean, and I think Callum's touching on this issue, and we heard Bill Belichick saying, as the coach of the team, I'm primarily responsible for the people that we bring into the football operation. So one of the obvious subplots here is how rigorous the Patriots are, indeed how rigorous NFL teams are in general in selecting and promoting players. How does that aspect of this story play out? How is it playing out in your view?
Well, I think those folks are willing to overlook a lot because you're bringing someone in for their skill on the football field.
Right.
And at a minimum, you're not bringing them in because they happen to be nice people, and sometimes they're not decent people. But I think what struck me about Belichick in the news conference the other day is exactly as Callum described it, that the father figure who maybe thought, you know, you could bring someone in, you could work with them, you can overlook a lot and maybe teach them better ways and hopefully also win a championship in the process. And the sad realization is that you couldn't with Hernandez. And it wasn't that he fell off, you know, the wagon. It was that he went on and murdered someone allegedly. And so I think that it was a very sad moment for Belichick and his team because that realization that you couldn't fix Hernandez and not only that, but that he was a member of a team, that you put him in the locker room, that he was associating with the other people about whom you care a good deal. And I think that is very troubling to the organization.
We've heard from Robert Kraft. We heard this week from Belichick, from Tom Brady. I mean, is it your sense, and I'll ask you both this question, that the Patriots have been as open as they need to be, should be, about this, Callum?
I think they have. I think that they are probably not going to spend a lot of time talking about it going forward. I think to some degree that there is an unfair double standard in that in most cases, in most murder cases, we don't frequently demand such scrutiny of that person's employer. You know, where we go and say, well, how well did you know this person and why did you hire them in the first place? You know, I think this is sort of a unique case in that respect. A key difference, of course, is that, you know, the Patriots are much more high profile. We're talking about a lot more money involved. So I'm not saying that the two are entirely equal. But I think that, you know, they came out, they answered the questions to some degree. And I think that a lot of football fans, frankly, are ready to put this behind them, too. Training camp is open, finally. Mm-hmm. You know, we got preseason games coming up in a couple weeks. And I think that, you know, folks are ready to talk football now.
You share that view, Peter?
I do. I do think, though, the Patriots have given themselves an additional burden because Kraft's late wife had made a point when she was involved with the team of suggesting that they wanted to bring in people of certain values. And so I think it's a complexity when you have someone on the record in the past trying to promote an organization that brings in good people. Clearly, since she's passed, the team has gone in a different direction and made different kinds of decisions. And I'm not sure that they necessarily should be faulted for that, but it does, you know, present another story to all of this.
Okay, gentlemen, this has been a lot of crime conversation. So let's take a deep breath and switch gears a little and talk about transportation, of course, because this week, Beacon Hill overrode Governor Patrick's veto on a major transportation bill. Here's House Speaker Robert DeLeo.
What I'm trying to do from today into next week is to get our fiscal house in order. And if we were going to do a good job in terms of fixing our transportation system, which is so important to our economy, we had to find alternative revenues.
Okay, so revenues in this case means $800 million. But Governor Patrick conveyed mixed feelings about the legislation, saying that it's no secret that today's transportation finance package shortchanges our transportation needs. That's what the governor says. It still represents a step forward. Callum, do you think it does indeed represent a step forward?
It does, although I think that the governor is right that it may not solve all the problems. Of course, the big question mark that he keeps raising is, are we going to continue to have the tolls on the Mass Turnpike? Because if those go away several years down the line, then you're still going to have this hole to fill, right? And that was part of his objection in the first place. For him politically, I think it's sort of an interesting situation because, you know, his accusers, I think, can come in and sort of say, were you grandstanding a little bit here? I mean, this was basically a foregone conclusion. We knew that the legislature had the votes to override his veto. And, of course, he knew that as well. And so I wonder if he really thought that there wouldn't be any progress if he would have vetoed the bill. You know what I mean? I think he knew that it was going to happen anyway, and then he gets to sort of just make his point.
Well, Peter, briefly on this front, this seems to be one of the big stories coming out of the transportation bill, that it is essentially a whittling down of Governor Patrick's initial big idea.
Well, he clearly wanted to take the legislature to a place that did not want to go. There was no inkling that the legislature was ever going to go as far as the governor wanted. Some folks were very public that they were surprised by the grandiosity of the governor's plan, and there was no indication they were going to go there. So I think it is an important and very good step in the right direction. Legislators are very wary. They know the governor is leaving office. They don't want to leave office. And so they're very concerned about the size of the package that the governor presented. I think that they're still concerned about what they've just done and are listening very closely to see what the political rumblings in all of their districts are going to be as a result of this. I don't think it's going to be as negative as many of them think it will be.
So I think we should move on. We've got just enough time for our hubbubs, that story that fell below the fold this week. Meghna, let's start with your hubbub.
Okay, so my hubbub actually takes us back to the Bulger case and sort of one of the weird sidelines of it, because apparently the Discovery Channel is starting a new reality show called Saint Hoods. It's a dramatization of Bookies in Boston. And it seems as if one of the bookies in the Bulger case, Stephen Nee, I believe, if I've got the name right. Yeah, Steve, he's been tapped to be in this reality show, which takes us back to what we were talking about earlier, that there's completely different conceptions outside of Boston of what the Bulger case means. And obviously, many of the victims' families are very unhappy about this. They even contacted the Discovery Channel to protest the existence of the show. We'll see what goes on. But Saint Hoods could be coming to a cable, to your cable television near you sometime soon.
Oh, boy. Mark your calendars. Callum, your hubbub.
Yeah, lucky yes. I'll try to take us back more toward that innovation, although not straight to South Boston, but I had a chance to visit a new startup incubator called Bolt, which I wrote about this week. And it's actually downtown Boston, not really in South Boston, but I think it's one of the more interesting ones. We have several of these, right? We have Techstars and Mass Challenge, but what makes Bolt kind of interesting is that it's specifically for hardware startups. So imagine you're trying to, you have a great idea for that great new tech gadget that everybody's going to want to have in their hands. But how do you build the thing? Chances are you don't have the skills to do it yourself, and you probably don't know the first thing about finding a manufacturer in China, let's say, to make some prototypes for you. So what you can do now is you go to Bolt, and they'll give you the seed money in the startup space that these incubators are known for. But in addition to that, they've got $1 million worth of manufacturing equipment and mechanical and electrical engineers to actually help you build the prototypes. Fascinating place, and I'm excited to see what comes out of it.
Really interesting. Peter, how about you? Your hubbub.
Well, mine goes brings us south, specifically to Rio and this revolutionary pope that is very happy in the slums of the world. Hundreds of thousands of people are traveling to Rio for World Youth Day. The pope is leading. And it's remarkable to watch this man walk through some of the most violent slums in the world and seem utterly at peace and happier to be there than he is with the pomp and circumstance in Rome. And so, but one thing that he said there really struck me. He said that we knew that in Rio there would be great disorder, but I want trouble in the diocese. And he says he wants the church to get closer to the people. He was quite emphatic about that. This pope is going to cause a lot of those of us who are comfortable, relatively comfortable, to be uncomfortable with the message that that he is proclaiming quite loudly.
So here's my hubbub. And actually, Callum, you touched on this earlier, so I'm going to be really quick about this. State Senator Brian Joyce from Milton is pushing legislation in the State House to require ATMs to have panic buttons that dial 911. I think this is really interesting. Safe to say that this bill is going to get a much closer look in the wake of the tragic events this week in South Boston. And just a program note, coming up on All Things Considered, we're going to hear from State Senator Brian Joyce, who Sasha Pfeiffer will be talking to. So there is my hubbub. And that's it. Callum Borchers, business reporter for the Boston Globe, and Peter Upertasio, chair of the Political Science Department and director of the Joseph Martin Institute for Law and Society at Stonehill College. Thank you both very much. Have great weekends.
Thank you.
And by the way, I got that name wrong of Nee. It's Patrick Nee of South Boston. So correcting myself there, Patrick Nee. But for now, stick with us because coming up, a tale of two Boston institutions and the earliest days of the MFA. I'm Megan Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.